Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. News today that South Korean researchers have dramatically sped up the cloning of human embryos. Scientists call it a dramatic leap forward in stem cell research, and it didn't happen here. While Washington and many American states are struggling with the right regulation and ethical oversight of stem cell research, science is racing ahead. The implications, moral, medical, and economic, are huge. Tonight on Point, a stunning advance in human embryo cloning and science outpacing U.S. policy on stem cell research. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you heard the news? Korean scientists opening the door to large-scale production of cloned human embryos. What does it mean when research outpaces American policy on the cutting edge of biological science? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Boston is Gareth Cook, science reporter for the Boston Globe. He won a Pulitzer Prize this year for his reporting on stem cell research. Gareth Cook, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Gareth, a lot of excitement about this news out of Korea today. Can you explain to us what they've done and why people are so fired up about it?
Well, everyone's buzzing about this today. I think what they've done is basically shown that cloning is for real. Last year, they announced that they were able to clone human cells for the first time, but it was just one experiment, and nobody really knew how difficult it would be to do in the future. What they've done here is shown that they can do it reliably and quickly. This means that a lot of other scientists now are going to be following in their footsteps. And I think that raises a lot of political and ethical questions.
All right. Gareth, I want to talk about those dynamics, but I want to just bear down first on the science, because I think one of the issues here is that a lot of people just don't understand what it all means, and I'm not sure I really understand it. When they announced today that they've cloned, what, a dozen human embryos, first of all, this is not to produce cloned babies.
Exactly, yes. There's a lot of confusion about this whole area. So the aim here is not to create babies. It's to create lines of cells that you can either use to study or eventually that you might be able to use to treat people.
And in particular, stem cells.
Yes, so they've created embryonic stem cells, and these are cells which have the ability to become any other cell in the body. So we've been hearing a lot over the last few years about embryonic stem cells and their potential. These cells are very special, though, the ones the South Koreans have done, because they have made embryonic stem cells that have the precise DNA of a particular person, of a patient with a disease. So what they've been able to do is they take egg cells, they remove the nucleus from the egg cell, they put the nucleus, which contained, let's say they were going to do this with you, they would take the DNA from one of your cells, place it in this nucleus, and stimulate it to grow. It would grow for a few days, and from that they would get embryonic stem cells.
And those stem cells would match my genetic profile precisely.
Exactly. So if you had a disease, for example, scientists could study these embryonic stem cells and see if they can find the first moment when things go awry so that they can discover the cause of your disease. And also the other thing they might be able to do is correct this error and, in theory, give them back to you. And because it has the same DNA, your body probably would not reject them.
And this is exactly what the Koreans are looking at. They've taken, they've cloned stem cells with genetic material from a number of people with spinal cord injuries, from a girl with diabetes, from a two-year-old boy with a genetic congenital disorder of the immune system, and they will have then stem cells that could hypothetically feed right back to those people without a rejection fear.
Exactly. So that's sort of what broadly people are most excited about. But I think it's very important that your listeners understand that this is something that we don't know if that's going to work. We don't know if that's ever going to happen. But that's why so many scientists are so interested in this, because you might be able to cure people of diseases that we just can't cure right now.
Gareth, why did this happen in South Korea and not in the United States?
It happened because this team is extremely talented, first of all, but it happened because the South Korean government and South Korean society is very dedicated to having this work. And I think that if scientists here were working in the same environment, they would have achieved the same thing. And I think that if you catch them in a more honest moment, there are scientists at Harvard who find this very frustrating, that they're not the ones who did this first, that the South Koreans are the ones that did this first.
And when you say if Americans were working in the same environment, they'd already be there, what do you mean by the same environment? What's the difference between the environment, the research environment in South Korea on stem cells and the USA?
There are several differences. The most important difference is that the federal government does not fund this research. So if a scientist wanted to do this in the United States, they would have to raise private money to do this. And most science in the United States is funded with government money. And this work in South Korea was done with government money. So it introduces this that obstacle. Second of all, there's been a very large and loud political battle, not just about cloning, but also about embryonic stem cell research in general. And that has made institutions more wary of entering into this. And it just made it more difficult for scientists and for institutions because they don't really know what the rules of the road are. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing, what they should be doing. So there are two teams in the United States, both based at Harvard, actually, that want to do this. And they've been making plans to do this, but it's required a very long process of working through the issues with their institutions, and they're still not done with this. So they haven't been able to actually start doing the work, whereas in South Korea, they just started working.
Gareth, stand by if you would. I want to welcome to our conversation with me here in the studio tonight, George Daly. He's Associate Director of the Stem Cell Program at Boston Children's Hospital. He's a member of the Executive Committee of Harvard's Stem Cell Institute. George Daly, thanks so much for being
Good
with
evening.
Us. Gareth has said it. A lot of people are seeing it. You've said it. You've said this is a spectacular development in Korea that we're hearing about today. Of what magnitude?
It's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. And Gareth referred to the two groups at Harvard. Mine is one of them. We're doing this research in mice. We'd like to be doing it in humans with human cells.
And you're not because of the federal restrictions that President Bush announced months after he became president?
I think it's fair to say it's a combination of the federal funding restrictions, which makes it more difficult, but also the political climate. We might have been doing this work 4 years ago if the climate here had been more supportive as it is in Korea.
What are the implications of this happening in Korea? And it's not the first frontier pushed forward abroad. What are the implications for the United States?
Well, it means that for us to learn how to do this, the best way is to get on a plane and fly 24 hours and go visit the lab in Korea, which some of my colleagues have done, and I'm planning to do this November. It is something which is in some ways demoralizing to the scientific community here in the United States that our foreign colleagues our foreign competitors, if you will, are moving so far forward so quickly.
You say demoralizing, but there are many Americans, certainly many in Washington, who talk a lot about morals here. Are there, in the research that the Koreans have done, have there been moral lines crossed that the United States has not come to consensus about yet, or that would offend some number or a majority of Americans?
I think it all depends on your perspective. I think those of us in the field who work with these cells see this as a process in the petri dish. We see the ultimate goal of studying disease, answering fundamental questions, one day hopefully getting these cells into patients. We see that as a very, very vital form of medical research, highly justified, and we don't view it from the same sense of moral outrage that others do.
And, of course, the doctor who's pushing this forward there, one of the doctors, Wang Woo-suk, saying, look, we're out to find cures for Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, spinal cord injuries, burns, diabetes, stroke, heart disease, Huntington's disease, even arthritis. It's a long list. Gareth Cook, what about this issue? I'm not even sure how to ask this, but were moral lines or ethical lines crossed in Korea to produce this breakthrough that American scientists or American policymakers are unwilling to see crossed?
Well, I think that it just depends on your perspective, and I think there's at least two issues you need to have in mind. One is the issue that you hear about a lot, which is, when does life begin? And if you believe that life begins at conception, as a lot of Americans do, then you can view this research, which requires the destruction of embryos, you can view this research as fundamentally immoral, no matter what the potential of it is. The second thing that I think we need to be thinking about is the use of eggs. And for a woman to donate eggs for this research, it's a procedure that involves some risk. And I think that we as a society need to think about that more because we've not really confronted that question. I think the thrust of this paper, the thing that has people like Dr. Daly and others so excited is it's now clear that we need far fewer women to donate eggs. However, we still need to ask the question, what sort of risks should women be allowed to take to further this type of research?
Gareth, let me ask you just another very simple question. The embryos that are cloned, if they were, I've read it's against the law in South Korea to put those, to implant those in a woman to bring them through gestation, but could they hypothetically become fully formed human beings, these cloned embryos?
I think Dr. Dale would do better to answer this, but my answer to the question is yes, they could. I think that when we're talking about embryos, you're talking about something that could be placed into a woman and it could become a child. However, with embryos that are created this way, that is, with cloning, you know two things. First of all, we know two things from studying this in animals. First of all, it would be a lot more difficult. That is, you would need large numbers of embryos for it to ever succeed. It took an enormous amount of embryos to ever get Dolly the sheep. And the other thing we know from studying animals is that they're almost all abnormal. There are profound problems with these cloned animals. And so putting aside all sorts of philosophical questions you might have about the creation of a cloned human child, there's a simple fact that we could be almost certain that this child would have medical problems and probably profound medical problems.
But the Koreans are saying we have no intention of that kind of reproduction. And yet, Gareth, no one can, once this science is in hand, no one can guarantee that nobody will do it.
That's true. And I think that if you look at this paper, you see that they've provided even more details about how to do this. So if someone wanted to do that, they would be better able to do that because of this paper. However, it must be said that this is not a problem that's specific to stem cell research. This is a general problem with science. And that is, as our ability to master nature, if you will, increases, our ability to do bad things also increases. And so we need very severe societal restrictions that prevent people from doing this type.
We'll look at exactly that tonight. Gareth Cook, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the Boston Globe, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about a stunning new advance in human embryo cloning and science racing ahead of U.S. policy on stem cell research. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you heard the news? Korean scientists opening the door today to mass production of cloned human embryos. So, is the U.S. falling behind in a patchwork of regulation and hesitation? Do you want the U.S. to hang back when it comes to human embryo cloning? Or do you want the United States at the forefront of therapeutic cloning and the cures it may bring? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by George Daly, Associate Director of the Stem Cell Program at Boston's Children's Hospital. He's also a member of the Executive Committee of Harvard's Stem Cell Institute. We're joined right now from London by Kathy Hudson. She is Director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center at Johns Hopkins University. The center just released a report today called Cloning, a Policy Analysis, and she's been at the center of the kind of hubbub and excitement around the announcement of the Korean breakthrough today. Kathy Hudson, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So describe the scene there. I guess the news or the celebration of it was focused in London, and what kind of excitement?
Well, I'm here at a meeting that's focused on the science of genetic testing of embryos, and word was trickling through the participants of that meeting. At the same time, a press conference was happening across town.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting that they decided to have a press conference here in London rather than in Korea or in the United States, but we were happy to have it here.
Mm-hmm.
You're quite right. Gareth and George are quite right in enumerating the perceived benefits that were certainly articulated by the scientists here in London of the unique opportunity to study human disease, of the possibility of developing new treatments for debilitating diseases, and for advances in economic and scientific competitiveness. What I heard less of today in the scientific community were concerns about this research, which you certainly hear if you talk to the American public.
In the report that you're bringing out today, you write about national gridlock on stem cell research in the United States. What do you mean by that?
Well, since 1997, when Dolly, lamb, was cloned, we've had over 30 bills introduced in the U.S. Congress, and yet none have been enacted into law. So in the wake of inaction at the federal level, we're starting to see state laws popping up, and those state laws are all over the map. So we have a number of states that have banned both reproductive cloning, cloning to have an identical child, and research cloning. Other states are banning reproductive cloning, but actively promoting and supporting research cloning, and California and New Jersey are chief examples there, and Massachusetts has legislation pending.
In the middle of that debate right now, yes.
In the middle of that debate right now. And science really isn't a local enterprise. It's a national enterprise and a global enterprise. And so I think we're in some sort of tricky waters here as we have disparate policies across the United States and around the world.
And but some states really forging ahead. California voted last fall to put huge money towards stem cell research, actively promoting it.
Right. That's right.
So you write about what you call a widely disparate concerns, fears, and hopes creating a political impasse that we're hearing from Washington that Congress may actually end run President Bush on this. What's in the works there?
Well, you know, when the Koreans first announced the first cloned embryo and the first cloned stem cell line, nothing happened in Congress. So there was no breakage of the logjam. So I don't know that we can have a whole lot of room for optimism right now that we'll see a change in the current stalemate in Washington. And that's largely because there are three prominent concerns about research cloning. One is the destruction of embryos.
Mm-hmm.
So those who believe that human life at all stages has maximum moral worth and should be protected, those folks are not going to be convinced by this latest scientific advance. Others who would be comfortable with research cloning are nonetheless concerned that this places us atop a slippery slope without a guardrail, and it's going to inexorably lead us to reproductive cloning.
That is, cloning babies.
Right. And then the third concern, which I think has really been reduced by the new report, are the risks to and the coercion of women. So there were a lot of concerns that if it took hundreds of women's eggs to generate one cloned stem cell line, that women could be exploited. And the increase in efficiency that's been demonstrated now by the Koreans suggests that should be a much, much, much lesser concern.
And again, one of the doctors at the forefront there in Korea saying recently that they have a waiting list of Korean women, young women, who want to donate their eggs. And as he describes it, it's for all humankind, for cures, and for Korea's future, South Korea's future as a leader in this industry. You've been looking a lot. I guess I should point out here we have Dr. Leon Kass, chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics, on the other hand, saying today in an email message that whatever its technical merit, this research, the Korean research, is morally troubling. It creates human embryos solely for research, makes it much easier to produce cloned babies, and exploits women as egg donors, not for their benefit. So he's still stuck on that. This is the head of the President's Council, Kathy Hudson.
Well, he's not alone. So we did a survey of nearly 5,000 Americans last year, and we asked them how do they view embryos and fetuses at various stages of development, and how do they view embryos sitting in a petri dish in a laboratory as compared to an embryo in a woman's womb.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was that a quarter of Americans view an embryo in a petri dish as having maximum moral worth. So it should be protected against destruction in the same way that you would protect a born child. So even though that's a minority, it's a significant fraction of the American population.
And much higher than that among the evangelical population that cuts a wide swath in Washington right now.
Indeed. So if you look at approval for research cloning, you see a huge difference between those who have no religious affiliation and those who are evangelical or fundamentalist Christians. So, for example, 45% of the folks in our survey supported research cloning, those who had no religious affiliation supported research cloning, as compared to only 7% of evangelical and fundamentalist Christians.
Well, big news out of Korea today. Kathy Hudson hearing it there first in London and bringing us the results of her survey and research. Kathy, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's late there. We appreciate your being with us tonight.
Thank you.
George Daly, I want to keep going back to some very simple basics here because, you know, people are listening and trying to understand. And one thing that Kathy's report points out is that Americans have opinions, but they're also quite confused about what's what here. Is there, when you harvest stem cells from the embryos, like the Koreans have now done, human embryos, that means the embryo dies. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on what you mean by dies. I mean, in a sense, all cells are living. You know, we're mortal as individuals, but as a species, we're immortal. Our germ cells, our eggs and sperm, they are living cells. They give rise to embryos. The embryos can give rise to living cells. It really all depends on how you frame the question. The word cloning,
I understand what you mean, but let's just stick there for a moment because that sounds kind of cosmic compared to the frame of reference that's being used in the American political discourse. I mean, Leon Cass is saying today that the problem is it creates human embryos solely for research, and what he's saying there is you can't create an embryo that you're not going to then treat as Kathy says, give the value, the maximum value of a full human life. So he's equating it with a life. A life that ends when the stem cells are harvested, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it depends. What is a life? When does life begin versus when do we consider a person coming into being, a person that should be given all of the rights and privileges and protection of living, breathing beings?
I understand the philosophical point, and it's the ultimately important point, but let me just ask you again, very simply, an embryo is created through cloning. Stem cells are harvested from it. Does that matter, that embryo go on living, or is it then discarded once the stem cells...
No, you're absolutely right. The embryo deteriorates in the process, mm-hmm. and so what continues to grow and survive is living cells, and those cells are enormously valuable. Now, yes, if you equate the cluster of cells of the early human embryo with a human life or a human person, then you will never support this research. But if rather you see this as a non-sentient cluster of cells prior to any specialization, there's no nerve cells, there's no brain function here. If you see those cells as enormously valuable for the study of disease, for advancing medical research, and one day treating patients, then I think you see this work as highly morally justified.
You know what the pushback is. I mean, we'll hear some of it this evening, but I'm looking here at Dr. Richard Land. Again, he's been on our show, president of the Southern Baptist Convention. He says, we believe a cloned embryo is a human being. If that prevails as the American frame of reference, does it mean that the United States will not, if it prevails?
I don't think most people will actually think of the human embryo in a Petri dish as a human being. There is a dilemma now that's come into parlance, the fireman's dilemma. If a fireman is called to a fire at a fertilization clinic, mm-hmm. and you're faced with a choice of seeing a child in the waiting room and saving that child from the fire versus saving the 100 frozen embryos in the cryopreservation, mm-hmm. I don't think there's anyone in our community who wouldn't see a real distinction between real life, the child, and the potential life sitting in the freezer.
If Dr. Land's view should prevail, hypothetically, what would that mean for American science on this front?
Well, we have already accepted in our society in vitro fertilization. We have 40,000 babies born every year through assisted reproduction. We know that that process generates many more embryos than will ever become babies. Now, those embryos can be tossed out as medical waste, or they can be diverted, donated for medical research. We have accepted in vitro fertilization. I think as people get educated about the value of stem cell research, they will also accept nuclear transfer generation of customized embryonic stem cells.
But let me ask you again, if they don't, if they should not, if that's the way the country goes, what are the implications for this field of science? Can America prevail or be at the forefront and have Dr. Richard Land's view?
No, the work will go on. This is a global scientific community. The work is going on unabated in Korea, as we've learned today. Our colleagues in Singapore, in Japan, in China are actually putting extra emphasis on the research for the exact reason that the United States is leaving a vacuum. So there are issues. This will happen globally. We can either be part of that or we can be left in the dust.
George Daly, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation. Joining us from Minneapolis tonight is Hank Greeley. He's a bioethicist and professor of law at Stanford University. Hank Greeley, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Hi, George.
Hi, Hank.
So help us look at this in a global way. I mean, what we seem to be seeing, Kathy Hudson's telling us from London, George Daly telling us right here tonight, the United States is still in the midst of a big debate over this and the world moving ahead. So these things are happening. As a bioethicist, how do you deal with that? Whether or not the United States moves on this, it's clearly happening. The Koreans are now leaping way out in front. Does that mean something for how Americans should think about this, or does the United States just close its eyes to the rest of the world, make its own decisions about the ethics, and act on those in isolation?
Well, I guess I'd note first that my particular part of the United States is moving ahead quite quickly.
California, that is.
Has voted with 59% of the voters at the last election to borrow $3 billion to fund embryonic and other stem cell research over the next 10 years. So the United States is, as we all know, no monolith. Different states have gone different ways. Similarly, around the world, different countries have different rules. Singapore, Great Britain, Israel, Australia, a number of the South Korea, of course, the People's Republic of China, a number of countries are moving actively in this research. Other countries are not. In the long run, I think it would be a big loss to our science and to our place in the scientific world if we did not stay at the forefront of this.
And what about our ethics?
Well, that depends on what ultimately you think about the ethical question here. As Kathy Hudson pointed out, about 20 to 25% of the people that they surveyed thought that an in vitro embryo, an embryo in a petri dish, deserved full respect as a complete human being. That means that 75 to 80% of the population doesn't hold that view, which is certainly consistent with the conversations I've had and with the votes in California. It is, I think, at least worth noting that embryos die all the time. It is the case that this process kills embryos, but there are somewhere between 5 million and 15 million embryos that die naturally in the United States each year. Embryos created by sexual intercourse that never implant, never become a fetus, and never become a baby. Now, we don't know about most of those. If we think of each of those as an actual full human being, we should be holding a lot more funerals than we are. We don't treat early-stage embryos, even inside a woman, as being fully human in the same way that we treat babies or children or adults.
So you're seeing a kind of an odd double standard emerging here. Hank Greeley, George Daly, stand by. I want to begin to welcome our callers in. Richard is calling from Harlem in New York. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to find out, first of all, it's kind of obvious that if it doesn't happen here, it's going to happen in the rest of the world. But my question specifically is, one, can you quantify the success of, you know, stem cell research at the end of the day in dollars and cents? And does it make sense to have the debate from that perspective?
What do you mean quantify? You mean the economic value of it?
Yes, and exactly. And then my B part question is it illegal for United States scientists to set up shop in foreign countries?
In other words, can Americans do this research abroad? We've got it, Richard. Thank you very much for your call. Hank Greeley, if I may go first to you on the last part. As you say, there's already a patchwork of regulations across the country. It's not that American scientists are are they prohibited? Can they do anything they want? They just don't get federal funding? Or
In most states, American scientists can do this kind of research. They can do human embryonic stem cell derivations. They can do it through somatic cell nuclear transfer to create these cloned embryos, giving cloned embryonic stem cell lines. There are a few states in which that is clearly illegal, but most of the states, including most of the states with major biomedical institutions in them, make it legal. However, there is no federal funding available for that. That turns out to be really important for early-stage technologies. And this is still an early-stage technology. Pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies are interested in going the last 10 or 20% to bring something to market. But at a very early stage, we've relied for 50 years on federal funding to do basic research on medical advances. That federal funding is not available for this research, either with cloned embryonic stem cells or with any new embryonic stem cell lines at all.
So there's a real drag on the work. And George Daly, we've just got a minute before the break, but the economic implications, if this is going to potentially produce a cure for any of these, with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, spinal cord injuries, diabetes, heart disease, I mean, you name it, the economic implications if the United States is not a significant player here?
Well, no, the issue is it's very difficult to quantify, actually, the return on the investment in basic research. But there's no doubt that we in the scientific community believe that stem cell biology represents much of the foundation of an emerging new modality of medicine called regenerative medicine. We learned how to use chemicals to deliver them as drugs in the last century. The next century is going to see us learn how to use cells to directly repair degenerating organs. So it will have an enormous medical impact, and that will translate into an economic impact.
There's a lot more we want to learn tonight. We're so glad you're both with us. George Daly with me here in the studio with Harvard's Stem Cell Institute, and Hank Greeley, bioethicist at Stanford University. Listeners, you can join this conversation tonight. Are rapid advances elsewhere in the world making a joke of American caution? Is the United States losing out on a life sciences revolution that will take place without it? Or is America a moral beacon on this front? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking tonight about a stunning new advance in human embryo cloning and science racing ahead of U.S. policy on stem cell research. You can join us tonight. Have you heard the news? Korean scientists opening the door to mass production of cloned human embryos. What do you think? Will Americans still take a pass when and if other nations start pumping out dramatic new cures? Can we have American ethics and American breakthroughs on this front? When? How? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by George Daly of Harvard's Stem Cell Institute, by Hank Greeley, a bioethicist and professor of law at Stanford University, and right now from Bristol, Tennessee, by David Stevens. He is executive director of the Christian Medical Association, the nation's largest faith-based organization of doctors. Mr. Stevens, thank you for being with us tonight.
It's great to be with you. I feel like Daniel in the lion's den tonight.
Well, don't be afraid. We want to hear exactly what you have to say. We were quoting Leon Cass earlier, saying that the research results coming out of Korea today are morally troubling. On the other side, you know very well the expectations that people have of what cures might come out of this. How do you look at what's going on there and whether or not it should be going on here?
Well, as a physician and bioethicist, I would share Leon Cass's view. This is morally troubling, and it does boil down to what you all have been talking about. What is the moral status of an embryo? And I think we need to look at that very carefully because, you know, to say that it's not a human being is disingenuous. It has our human genome. It's a living organism. You can argue about whether it's a person or not. To compare it to the fact that a lot of embryos die is disingenuous, really, because people die all the time in this country, but there's a difference if I go over next door and kill my neighbor. There's a difference morally and ethically. And if we kill an embryo, we have a moral responsibility for it. There's continuous self-directed growth that begins at that one cell stage, and there's no moral relevant break beyond that time. And we as humans maintain our ontological identity. What that means is this. Tom, you were you, and I was me when we were embryos. And if somebody had destroyed us at that point, we wouldn't be having that conversation we're having right now. No other embryo would have become us. So when you destroy an embryo, you destroy a distinct human being. And those embryos that were made in Korea were the identical genetic twins of the people that they were cloned from.
Very deliberately so. Very deliberately so. Dr. Stevens, let me ask you about this then in the context of the breakthroughs that are going on around the world, the breakthrough here that's announced today. I guess, first of all, looking down, I understand your argument, and we've heard it. We've heard it before on this show, and we're happy to have it represented. But looking down the road, when and if, let's say, the Koreans or Singaporeans or the British push ahead and develop these cures that people are hoping for Parkinson's, for Alzheimer's, for heart disease, and right on down the line, and then what happens then to the moral argument? Does it change? Do you think that Americans, if Americans aren't doing this, do you think they won't take advantage of those cures, that they won't go to Korea, that the Americans will still hold the line when there are cures sitting on the table produced through this path?
Well, some people will obviously take the cure and some will not. That 25% or larger number, different numbers in different polls, may not. I wouldn't. I wouldn't try to save my life or the life of a loved one at the expense of another life. I think that's important to understand. And we need to understand this is not the only option for regenerative medicine. It's kind of been presented either we do this or we don't have the cures. Where we're really seeing remarkable success is not in embryonic stem cell research, where there are no clinical applications, But where we're seeing it was with adult stem cells, and some of the best reports have come out of Korea as well, including a patient in November who had umbilical cord stem cells injected directly into her spine. She had a complete hemiparalysis, and in 6 weeks she was up and walking with braces. We have other alternatives than embryonic stem cells to get the cures that all of us want. I take care of these patients as well.
If I may, let me just turn to my guest here in the studio, Dr. Stevens. George Daly, I see you shaking your head at that. On the adult stem cell front, is it equally promising?
Well, I mean, I wish it were true. I wish that adult stem cells offered all the answers. The fact is that adult stem cells are fundamentally different from embryonic stem cells.
Not as adaptable? Is that
well, it's you know, like studying the branches and leaves of a tree as opposed to the seed. You address different questions by studying adult stem cells or embryonic stem cells. Adult stem cells are likely to be more valuable for treating certain conditions. Unfortunately, not all adult organs harbor stem cells. So for the treatment of certain diseases, for instance, diabetes, we don't believe there are adult stem cells. So for treating diabetes, we believe the greatest promise lies in embryonic stem cells. I think most scientists don't see this as an either-or. Most scientists think that we need to be studying both.
Dr. Stevens, if I may ask you then, imagine from a, we don't know how this is going to turn out. If it should be, ultimately, that embryonic turns out to be the more productive path, can you picture a situation in which the United States gets kind of fundamentally left behind in science and economically, for that matter? And is that okay with you if it turns out that way, because you're standing on the right moral ground, in your view?
Well, I think that's part of it. But I think trying to claim the argument that everybody else is doing it, we should too, kind of harbors back to our childhood. We used to say that to our parents. Everybody else is doing it, Mom and Dad. Why can't I? We need to look at this very clearly in the science. Embryonic stem cells have been very difficult to establish and maintain in culture. They're difficult to control their differentiation. They're difficult to get a pure culture. You have problems with tumor formation. They have genomic instability and mutations. They have functional abnormalities. There's been a few successes in animals. When you look at adult stem cells, we have scientists in Spain that are using olfactory bulb adult stem cells on 34 patients who have spinal paralysis. Scientists at Harvard, where Dr. Daly is, actually have cured diabetes, type 1 diabetes in mice, and now have NIH permission to go with a human study.
And we hear you hoping and pushing hard in that direction, and we thank you for joining us tonight. David Stevens at the Christian Medical Association, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
I want to get to a caller here, if I may. Mouse is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Mouse. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to say I have a family history of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yes.
And as it stands right now, the best hopes for any sort of treatment is through stem cell research. And since most of these embryos, or all of these embryos, are going to be destroyed or slated to be destroyed anyways, I really don't see a problem with using them for some good.
And what if they were not going to be destroyed? What if they were created specifically for the purpose of trying to cure ALS?
If it wasn't for the research on this, they wouldn't exist in the first place. And as far as the fact that there's human genome in there was human genome in parts of me that were surgically removed, and that doesn't make it killing me. That just makes it part of my life.
So with your family medical history, you say, yes, please, bring it on. Hank Greeley, is there, from a bioethics view, is there an equation between the good that this might do and the perceived moral harm that some see here, or do you look at those in one calculation?
It depends on your view of ethics, actually. There are people who look more at the consequences and weigh the pluses and minuses of results. There are other folks who believe that there are certain principles that can't be crossed, and that this crosses one of them, and that by breaching one of those core principles, you take yourself out of the cost-benefit kind of analysis that the other ethicists would use, and then there are people who are somewhere in between. But I was really struck by something Dr. Stevens said, and would like to draw attention to it, and I think the last caller's call makes it even more relevant.
Yes.
He said that, you know, if cures were created this way, he wouldn't use them himself, and he wouldn't try to save his loved ones with them. That strikes me as extraordinary. The idea that if there is a cure developed from embryonic stem cells that could save a child or a grandchild from death, one wouldn't use it because of concerns about the way the treatment was created. sort of like saying we wouldn't take a heart transplant from a murder victim because we disagree with murder. Even if you thought this was murder, the idea of trying to keep these treatments from suffering people strikes me as amazing. Dr. Stevens himself certainly has the complete right to refuse any medical treatment he wants, as does any competent adult. But I suspect that a tiny fraction of Americans will turn down cures or treatments because of the source of the research that led to them.
I want to ask, in the just 2 minutes we have left, we take your point. I want to ask you just briefly, Hank Greeley, and then I'll turn to George Daly. As we sit here tonight, with this announcement out of Korea and everything else going on, is the United States behind? Will it, with its current patchwork of regulations, catch up?
Well, yes, we're clearly behind, but at least we're behind the South Koreans on this very impressive improvement they've made in the process. Will we catch up or not is hard to say. My hope is that California, at least, will catch up. We are devoting enormous resources to it and have a lot of talent. I hope that the rest of the country will join us.
And George Daly, your assessment, how far behind, if the country is behind, and what's your assessment? Will it catch up with its current patchwork of policies and regulations?
Well, I am very worried that we are behind, there's no doubt, but I have great confidence in the ingenuity of American scientists. I certainly hold out great hope that with political effort in Washington, that the current federal policies will be liberalized, that we'll have greater access to this research in the future, and that we'll be able to catch up and hopefully move ahead.
You see it still possible?
I'm perhaps quixotic, but definitely confident.
Oh, okay, there's a combination for us. We're dealing with lots of contrasts here tonight. Hank Greeley, bioethicist and professor of law at Stanford University, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And George Daly, here with me in the studio, associate director of the Stem Cell Program at Boston Children's Hospital and on the executive committee at Harvard Stem Cell Institute. Thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
We heard earlier from David Stevens of the Christian Medical Association and from Kathy Hudson, director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center at Johns Hopkins University. In a moment, Star Wars fans take filmmaking into their own hands. This is On Point. The Wookiees and Stormtroopers have been out in force since late last night, lining up outside theaters to be among the first to see Revenge of the Sith, the last installment, we're told, in the Star Wars saga. But Episode 3 is not the only Star Wars film created this year. More than 100 passionate Star Wars fans devoted weeks and months to creating their own Star Wars short films for the 4th annual Star Wars Fan Film Awards. This year's winners included a lightning-fast Japanimation version of the entire Star Wars tale in 5 minutes, and a spoof on Donald Trump's The Apprentice, where the evil Senator Palpatine is seeking an understudy. Mika Salmi is the CEO of Adam Films, which hosts the awards with the blessing of George Lucas. In this radio diary, he takes us through some of this year's entries.
Over the years, we've had thousands of people actually create these films, and what's interesting is that people seem to be creating these films all the time, whether there's a contest or not, which I think is very interesting. And then this year, obviously, it's a contest, and there was prizes, and there was some kind of accolades if you did well. So they definitely brought out a little more professional, potentially, efforts, but generally, people are creating these all the time. We get creations from everything from teenagers to senior citizens, and it's, you know, everything from a camcorder, people acting things out, to actual digital productions using their computers. And everything from who are semi-professionals who work in Hollywood create these things to there was one guy who worked at Walmart, another guy who worked actually in a store at Target. I think the best ones we have actually tends to be the ones people are from amateurs who just put their kind of passion and love in there.
Of the Sith, legends speak, great badasses they were. They say only two there are. A master and an apprentice. But comes the day when the apprentice becomes the master, a new apprentice choose they must. But how is this done? Shrouded in secrecy it was, until now.
Sith Apprentice is a spoof on the show The Apprentice, And in that film, the opening sequence uses a lot of digital techniques, and it looks like you're watching a Star Wars film. It's astounding. The first few minutes, you're just blown away by what you're seeing. You actually think you're watching a professional production that you may see on a big screen. Then the film goes on into the whole spoof around, you know, who's going to get fired, essentially.
Recently, I summoned those with the darkest hearts to come to Coruscant for the chance to win the dream job for any bad guy. They have faced many challenges, and many have already been defeated, leaving only these four, the best of the worst. Darth Maul.
At last we will reveal ourselves to the Jedi. At last we will have revenge.
Jar Jar Binks.
This is gonna show everyone how bad Mr. really is.
Count Dooku.
I thought Pete Cushing was going to be here.
And Darth Vader.
If I run out of admirals, I'll just promote a few stormtroopers.
Now, these final four will go head-to-head in the most demanding job audition ever. Only one will get the job of a lifetime. Only one will prevail to become my new Sith apprentice.
May the best Sith win.
So George Lucas selected For Love of the Film as the George Lucas Selects Award. The basic storyline on For the Love of the Film is that people are in the theater watching the first Star Wars film, and the projector breaks in the middle of it, and so people get up and actually act out the rest of the film in the theater. So every audience member in the theater takes some part and they act out the rest of the film.
That's your uncle talking, Luke.
Oh boy, my uncle. How am I ever going to explain this?
Learn about the Force.
Look, I can take you as far as Anchorhead. You can take a transport from there to Mos Eisley or wherever you're going.
You must do what you feel is right, of course.
Traveling through hyperspace ain't like dusting crops, boy. Without precise calculations, you could fly right through a star, bounce off a supernova, and that end your trip real quick now, wouldn't it?
Grr.
I think Star Wars is definitely an interesting category. It's part of the reason why we picked up on it back in 1999, is that it just seemed like it brought out these hardcore fans, and they were creating their own things. If you look at what has been written about Star Wars and what's people's general impression of Star Wars, it has this kind of classic structure to it. And I think the characters and the classic struggle that's happening in the film really inspire people to look at it in a broader sense. It's a bit like how Shakespeare has inspired a lot of other people. I think Star Wars has a similar role for a lot of people, that it inspires people to take the story to another level from what they've seen in the original story.
Mike Salmi is the CEO of Atom Films, which presents the annual Star Wars Fan Film Awards. For more information and to view this year's entries, check out our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. May the Force be with you. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
We're funded by you.